This is Audible.
Catherine Tegan Books and Harper Audio present The Lady's Guide to Petticoats and Piracy by Mackenzie Lee, performed by Maura Quirk. Don't tell me women are not the stuff of heroes. Cho Jin. A highly dowered girl was faced by a great venture, a great quest. The life before her was an uncharted sea. She had to find herself, to find her way, to find her work. Margaret Todd, M.D., The Life of Sophia Jex Blake. Edinburgh. 17. 1. I have just taken an overly large bite of iced bun when Callum slices his finger off. We are in the middle of our usual nightly routine, after the bakery is shut and the lamps along the cowgate are lit, their syrupy glow creating halos against the twilight. I wash the day's dishes and Callum dries. Since I am always finished first, I get to dip into whatever baked goods are left over from the day while I wait for him to count the till. Still on the counter are the 3 iced buns I have been eyeing all day. The sort Callum piles with sticky, translucent frosting to make up for all the years his father, who had the shop before him, skimped on it. Their domes are beginning to collapse from a long day unpurchased, the cherries that top them slipping down the sides. Fortunately, I have never been a girl over-bothered with aesthetics. I would have happily tucked into buns far uglier than these. Callum is always a bit of a hand-wringer who doesn't enjoy eye contact, but he's jumpier than usual tonight. He stepped on a butter mould this morning, cracking it in half, and burnt 2 trays of brioche. He fumbles every dish I pass him and stares up at the ceiling as I prod the conversation along, his already ruddy cheeks going even redder. I do not particularly mind being the foremost conversationalist out of the pair of us. Even on his chattiest days I usually am, or he lets me be. As he finishes drying the cutlery, I am telling him about the time that has elapsed since the last letter I sent to the Royal Infirmary about my admission to their teaching hospital, and the private physician who last week responded to my request to sit in on one of his dissections with a 3-word missive. No, thank you. Maybe I need a different approach, I say, pinching the top off an iced bun and bringing it up to my lips, though I know full well it's too large for a single bite. Callum looks up from the knife he's wiping and cries, "Wait, don't eat that!" with such vehemence that I startle, and he startles, and the knife pops through the towel and straight through the tip of his finger. There's a small plop as the severed tip lands in the dishwater. The blood starts at once, dripping from his hand and into the soapy water, where it blossoms through the suds like poppies bursting from their buds. All the colour leaves his face as he stares down at his hand, then says, "Oh dear." It is, I must confess, the most excited I have ever been in Callum's presence. I can't remember the last time I was so excited. Here I am with an actual medical emergency and no male physicians to push me out of the way to handle it. With a chunk of his finger missing, Callum is the most interesting he has ever been to me. I leaf through the mental compendium of medical knowledge I have compiled over years of study, and I land, as I almost always do, on Dr. Alexander Platt's Treatise on Human Blood and Its Movement Through the Body. In it, he writes that hands are complex instruments. Each contains 27 bones, 4 tendons, 3 main nerves, 2 arteries, 2 major muscle groups, and a complex network of veins that I'm still trying to memorize, all wrapped up in tissue and skin and capped with fingernails. There are sensory components and motor functions affecting everything from the ability to take a pinch of salt to bending at the elbow that begin in the hand and run all the way into the arm, any of which can be mucked up by a misplaced knife. Callum is staring wide-eyed at his finger, still as a rabbit, dazed by the snap of a snare and making no attempt to staunch the blood. I snatch the towel from his hand and swaddle the tip of his finger in it, for the priority when dealing with a wound spouting excessive blood is to remind that blood that it will do far more good inside the body than out. It soaks through the cloth almost immediately, leaving my palms red and sticky. My hands are steady, I notice with a blush of pride, even after the good jolt my heart was given when the actual severing occurred. I have read the books. I have studied anatomical drawings. I once cut open my own foot in a horribly misguided attempt to understand what the blue veins I can see through my skin look like up close. And though comparing books about medicine to the actual practice is like comparing a garden puddle to the ocean, I am as prepared for this as I could possibly be. This is not how I envisioned attending to my first true medical patient in Edinburgh. In the back room of the tiny bake shop I've been toiling in to keep myself afloat between failed petition after failed petition to the university and a whole slew of private surgeons begging for permission to study. But after the year I've had, I'll take whatever opportunities to put my knowledge into practice that are presented, gift horses and mouths and all that. Here, sit down. I guide Callum to the stool behind the counter, where I take coins from his customers, for I can make change faster than Mr. Brown, the second clerk. Hand over your head, I say, for if nothing else, gravity will work in favour of keeping his blood inside his body. He obeys. I then fish the wayward fingertip from the wash basin, coming up with several chunks of slimy dough before I finally find it. I return to Callum, who still has both hands over his head, so that it looks as though he's surrendering. He's pale as flour, or perhaps that is actually flour dusting his cheeks. He's not a clean sort.
"Is it bad?"
he croaks. "Well, it's not good, but it certainly could have been worse. Here, let me have a look." He starts to unwrap the towel, and I qualify, "No, lower your arms. I can't look at it all the way up there." The bleeding has not stopped, but it has slowed enough that I can remove the towel long enough for a look. The finger is less severed than I expected. While he's sliced off a good piece of his fingerprint and a wicked crescent of the nail, the bone is untouched. If one must lose a part of one's finger, this is the best that can be hoped for. I pull the skin on either side of the wound up over it. I have a sewing kit in my bag, as I have 3 times lost the button from my cloak this winter and grew tired of walking around with the ghastly wind of the Nur Loch flapping its tails. All it takes is 3 stitches, in a style I learned not from a general system of surgery, but rather from a hideous pillow cover my mother pestered me into embroidering a daft-looking dog upon to hold the flap in place. A few drops of blood still ooze up between the stitches, and I frown down at them. Had they truly been upon a pillowcase, I would have ripped them out and tried again. But considering how little practice I've had with sealing and amputation, particularly one so small and delicate, and how much it slowed the bleeding, I allow myself a moment of pride before I move on to the second priority of Dr. Platt's treatise on wounds of the flesh, holding infection at bay. "Stay here," I say, as though he has any inclinations to move. "I'll be right back." In the kitchen, I bring water to a quick boil over the stove, still warm and easily stoked, then add wine and vinegar before soaking a towel in the mixture and returning to where Callum is still sitting wide-eyed behind the counter.
"You're not going to... Do you have to... cut it off?"
he asks. "No, you already did that," I reply. "We're not amputating anything, just cleaning it up."
"Oh."
He looks at the wine bottle in my fist and swallows hard.
"I thought you were trying to dose me."
"I thought you might want it." I offer him the bottle, but he doesn't take it.
"I was saving that."
"What for? Here, give me your hand." I blot the stitching, which is much cleaner than I had previously thought. I'm far too hard on myself with the soaked towel. Callum coughs with his cheeks puffed out when the vinegar tang strikes the air. Then it's a strip of cheesecloth around the finger, bound and tucked. Stitched, bandaged and sorted. I haven't even broken a sweat. A year of men telling me I am incapable of this work only gives my pride a more savage edge, and I feel, for the first time in so many long, cold, discouraging months, that I am as clever and capable and fit for the medical profession as any of the men who have denied me a place in it. I wipe my hands off from my skirt and straighten, surveying the bakery. In addition to every other task that needs doing before we close up for the night, the dishes will need to be re-washed. There's a long dribble of blood along the floor that will have to be scrubbed before it dries, another on my sleeve, and a splatter across Callum's apron that should be soaked out before tomorrow. There is also a fingertip to be disposed of. Beside me, Callum takes a long, deep breath and lets it hiss out between pursed lips as he examines his hand.
"Well, this rather spoils the night."
"We were just washing up."
"Well, I had something else."
He pushes his chin against his chest.
"For you."
"Can it wait?" I ask. I'm already calculating how long this will leave Callum useless over the ovens, whether Mr. Brown will be able to lend a hand, how much this will cut into my time off this week, which I had planned to use to begin a draft of a treatise in favour of educational equality.
"No, it's not. I mean, I suppose it could, but..."
He's picking at the edges of the bandage, but stops before I can reprimand him. He's still pale, but a bit of the ruddiness is starting to return to the apples of his cheeks.
"It's not something that will last."
"Is it something for eating?" I ask.
"Something of a... just stay there."
He wobbles to his feet in spite of my protestations and disappears into the kitchen. I hadn't noticed anything special when I was mixing the wine and vinegar, but I also hadn't been particularly looking for it. I check my fingers for blood, then swipe a clean one over the iced bun I had previously targeted.
"Don't strain yourself," I call to him.
"I'm not,"
he replies, immediately followed by a crash like something tin knocked over.
"I'm fine. Don't come back here."
He appears behind the counter again, more red-faced than before, and one sleeve sopping with what must have been the milk he so raucously spilled. He's also clutching a fine china plate before him in presentation, and upon it sits a single perfect cream puff. My stomach drops, the sight of that pastry sending a tremble through me that a waterfall of blood had not.
"What are you eating?"
he asks at the same moment I say, "What is that?" He sets the plate on the counter, then holds out his uninjured hand in presentation.
"It's a cream puff."
"I can see that."
"It is, more specifically, because I know you love specificity."
"I do, yes."
"Exactly the cream puff I gave you the day we met."
His smile falters, and he qualifies,
"Well, not exactly that one, as that was months ago, and since you ate that one, and several more."
"Why did you make me this?" I look down at the two shoe halves with whorls of thick cream sculpted between them. He's never this careful with his craftsmanship. His loaves and cakes, the kind of rustic you'd expect to be made by a big-handed baker of good Scotch stock. But this is so deliberate and decorative and... zoons! I can't believe I know exactly what type of pastry this is, and how important it is to let the flour mixture cool before whisking in the egg. All this baking nonsense is taking up important space in my head that should be filled with notations on treating popliteal aneurysms and the different types of hernias outlined in Treatise on Ruptures, which I took great pains to memorise.
"Maybe we should sit down," he says. "I'm a little faint."
"Likely because you lost blood."
"Or, yes, That must be it.
This really can't wait, I ask, as I lead him over to one of the tables crowded in the front of the shop. He carries the cream puff, and it wobbles on the plate as his hand shakes. You should go home and rest, at least close the shop tomorrow, or Mr. Brown can supervise the apprentices, and we can keep everything simple. They can't muck up a bread roll too badly. He makes to pull the chair out for me, but I wave him away. If you are insistent upon moving forward with whatever this is, at least sit down before you fall over. We take opposite sides, pressed up against the cold, damp window. Down the road, the clock from St. Giles's is striking the hour. The buildings along the Cowgate are grey with the twilight, and the sky is grey, and everyone passing the bakery is wrapped in grey wool. And I swear I haven't seen colour since I came to this godforsaken place. Callum sets the cream puff on the table between us, then stares at me, fiddling with his sleeve.
Oh, the wine.
He casts a glance over at the counter, seems to decide it's not worth going back for, then looks again to me, his hands resting on the tabletop. His knuckles are cracked from the dry winter air, fingernails short and chewed raw around the edges.
"Do you remember the first day we met?"
he blurts. I look down at the cream puff, dread beginning to spread in my stomach like a drop of ink in water. "I remember quite a lot of days."
"But that one in particular?"
"Yes, of course." It was a humiliating day. It still stings to think of it. Having written 3 letters to the university on the subject of my admission and received not a word in reply for over 2 months, I went to the office myself to investigate whether they had arrived. As soon as I gave my name to the secretary, he informed me that my correspondence had indeed been received, but no, it had not been passed on to the Board of Governors. My petition had been denied without ever being heard, because I was a woman, and women were not permitted to enrol in the hospital teaching courses. I was then escorted from the building by a soldier on patrol, which just seemed excessive, though it would be a lie to say I did not consider sprinting past the secretary and bursting through the door into the governor's hall without permission. I wear practical shoes and can run very fast. But, having been unceremoniously deposited on the street, I had consoled myself at the bake shop across the road, drowning my sorrows in a cream puff made for me by a round-faced baker with the figure of a man to whom cakes are too available. When I had tried to pay him for it, he'd given me my coins back, and as I was finishing it, at this very table beside this very window, oh, Callum was truly digging in the talons of sentimentality by sitting us here, he made a tentative approach with a mug of warm cider and, after a good chat, an offer of employment. He had looked then like he was trying to lure a snappish dog in from the cold to lie beside his fire, like he knew what was best for me, if only my stubborn heart could be enticed there. He looks the same way now, earnestly presenting me that same sort of cream puff, his chin tipped down so that he's looking up at me through the hedgerow of his eyebrows.
"Felicity," he says, my name wobbling in his throat. "We've known each other for a while now."
"We have," I say, and the dread thickens.
"And I've become quite fond of you, as you know."
"I do." And I did. After months of counting coins with my side pressed against his in the cramped space behind the counter and our hands overlapping when he passed me trays of warm rolls, it had become apparent that Callum was fond of me in a way I couldn't make myself be fond of him. And though I had known of the existence of this fondness for a time, it had not been a matter of any urgency that required addressing. But now he's giving me a cream puff and recollecting, telling me how fond he is of me. I jump when he takes my hand across the table, an impulsive lunging gesture. He pulls away just as fast, and I feel terrible for startling. So I hold my hand out in invitation, and let him try again. His palms are sweating, and my grip so unenthusiastic, I imagine it must be akin to cuddling a filleted fish.
"Felicity," he says, and then again, "I'm very fond of you."
"Yes," I say.
"Very fond."
"Yes." I try to focus on what he's saying, and not of how to get my hand out of his without hurting his feelings, and also if there's any possible scenario in which I can walk away from this with that cream puff, but without having to do any more than hold his hand.
"Felicity," he says again,
and when I look up, he's leaning across the table toward me with his eyes closed and his lips jutting out. And here it is, the inevitable kiss. When Callum and I first met, I had been lonely enough to not only accept his employment, but also the companionship that came with it, which gave him the idea that men often get in their heads when a woman pays some kind of attention to them, that it was a sign I want him to smash his mouth, and possibly other body parts, against mine, which I do not. But I close my eyes and let him kiss me. There is more of a lunge into the initial approach than I would prefer, and our teeth knock in a way that makes me wonder if there's a business in selling Dr. John Hunter's newly advertised live tooth transplants to women who have been kissed by overly enthusiastic men. It's nowhere near as unenjoyable as my only previous experience with the act, though just as wet and just as dispassionate a gesture, the oral equivalent of a handshake. Best to get it over with, I think. So I stay still and let him press his lips to mine, feeling as though I'm being stamped like a ledger, which is apparently the wrong thing to do, because he stops very abruptly and falls back into his chair, wiping his mouth on his sleeve.
"I'm sorry. I shouldn't have done that."
"No, it's all right," I say quickly, and it was. It hadn't been hostile or forced upon me. Had I turned away, I know he wouldn't have chased me, because Callum is a good man. He walks on the outside of the pavement, so he takes the splash of the carriage wheels through the snow instead of me. He listens to every story I tell, even when I know I've been taking up more than my share of the conversation. He stopped adding almonds to the sweetbreads when I told him almonds make my throat itch.
"Felicity," Callum says, "I'd like to marry you."
Then he drops off his chair and lands with a hard thunk against the floor that makes me concerned for his kneecaps.
"Sorry, I got the order wrong."
I almost drop too, though not in chivalry. I'm feeling far fainter in the face of matrimony than I did at the sight of half a finger in the dishwater.
"What?
Did you..."
He swallows so hard, I see his throat travel the entire course of his neck.
"Did you not know I was going to ask you?"
In truth, I had expected nothing more than a kiss, but suddenly feel foolish for thinking that was all he wanted from me. I fumble around for an explanation for my willful ignorance, and only come up with, "We hardly know each other."
"We've known each other almost a year," he replies.
"A year is nothing," I protest. "I've had dresses I wore for a year, and then woke up one morning and thought, why am I wearing this insane dress that makes me look like a terrier mated with a lobster?"
"You never look like a lobster," he says.
"I do when I wear red," I say, "and when I blush, and my hair is too red, and I wouldn't have time to plan a wedding right now because I'm busy and tired and I have so much to read, and I'm going to London."
"You are?"
he asks. "You are?" I ask myself at the same time I hear myself saying, "Yes, I'm leaving tomorrow."
"Tomorrow?"
"Yes, tomorrow." Another revelation to myself. I have no plans to go to London. It sprang from me, a spontaneous and fictitious excuse crafted entirely from panic. But he's still on his knee, so I push on with it. "I have to see my brother there. He has..." I pause too long for my next word to be anything but a lie, then say, syphilis. It's the first thing that comes to mind when I think of Monty.
Oh, oh dear.
Callum, to his credit, seems to be making a true effort to understand my nonsensical ramblings. Well, no, not syphilis, I say, but he's having terrible spells of boredom and asked me to come and read to him. And I'm going to be petitioning the hospital for admission again in the spring when they bring in new attending physicians, and that will take all my attention.
Well, if we married, you wouldn't have to worry about that.
Worry about what? I ask. Planning a wedding?
No.
He picks himself up off his bended knee and sinks back into his chair with far more slump to his shoulders than before.
About schooling.
I want to worry about that, I reply, the back of my neck prickling. I'm going to get a license and become a physician.
But that will...
He stops, teeth pressing so hard into his bottom lip it mottles white. I fold my arms.
That will what?
You're not serious about that, are you?
If I wasn't serious, I wouldn't have been able to sew you up just now.
I know.
You'd still be bleeding out over your wash basin.
I know that, and that was... You did a wonderful job.
He reaches out, like he might pat my hand, but I pull it off the table, for I am not a dog and therefore need no patting.
But we all have silly things that we want. Dreams, you know. And then, one day, you...
He scoops at the air with a hand, like he's trying to conjure appropriate phraseology between us, rather than being forced to say what he means.
For example, when I was a boy, I wanted to train tigers for the Tower Menagerie in London.
So train tigers, I reply flatly. He laughs, a small, nervous trill.
Well, I don't want to any more, because I have the shop, and I have a house here. What I meant is, we all have silly things we lose interest in because we want something real, like a house and a shop and a spouse and children. Not today, he stammers, for I must look petrified, but someday.
A different sort of dread begins to distill inside me now, strong and bitter as whiskey. Silly little things. That's all he thought my grand ambitions ever were. All this time, all these chats over scones, all his intense listening to me explain how, if the head were to be sawed off a corpse, one could trace paths of the 12 nerves connecting to the brain all the way through the body. One of the few who had not told me to give up, even when I had nearly told myself to, when I had written to surgeon after surgeon in the city, begging for teaching and received only rejections. I hadn't even been granted a single meeting once they discovered I was a woman. All the while we had been together, he'd been wondering when it was that I'd give up on this passing fancy, like it was a fashion trend that would disappear from shop windows by the end of the summer. I'm not training tigers, I say. It's medicine. I want to be a doctor.
I know.
They're not even comparable. There are doctors all over this city. No one would say it was silly or impossible if I was a man. You couldn't train tigers because you're just a baker from Scotland, but I have actual skills. His face falls before I register what I've said, and I try to backstep. Not that you... Sorry, I didn't mean that.
I know, he says, but someday you'll want something real. And I'd like to be that something for you.
He looks very intently at me, and I think he wants me to say something to assure him I take his meaning. And yes, he's right. I'm just a flighty thing with a passing interest in medicine that can be siphoned off once a ring is placed upon my finger. But all I can think to say is a snappish, and maybe someday the stars will fall from the sky. So I offer nothing in return but a frosty stare, the sort of look my brother once told me could put out a cigar. Callum tucks his chin into his chest, then blows out a long, hard breath that ruffles his fringy hair.
And if you don't want that too, then I don't want to do this anymore.
Do what?
I don't want you working here whenever you need money, and showing up at any hour you please, and eating all the buns and taking advantage of me because you know I've an affection for you. I either want to marry you, or I don't want to see you anymore.
I can't argue with any of that, though the fact that my heart sinks far further at the thought of losing this job than of losing Callum speaks volumes about the ill-advised nature of a union between us. I'm sure I could find something else to sustain me in this bleak, punishing city, but it would likely be even more menial and tedious than counting coins in a bakery, and would most certainly not include free desserts. I'd ruin my eyes making buttons in a smoggy factory, or wear myself ragged as a domestic, be blind and bent and consumptive by 25, and medical school would be soundly put to bed before I'd had a proper shot. We stare at each other. I'm not sure if he wants me to apologise, or agree, or admit that yes, that's what I've been doing, and yes, I've known I was using him badly, and yes, I will agree to his proposal in penance, and it will all have been worth it. But I stay quiet.
We should finish cleaning up, he says at last,
standing up and wiping his hands off on his apron with a wince.
You can eat the cream puff, even if you can't see yes right now.
I wish I could believe that yes was inevitable, the same way he seems to. It would be so much easier to want to say yes, to want a house on the Cowgate and a whole brood of round Doyle children with stubby Montague legs and a solid life with this kind, solid man. A small part of me, the part that traces my finger in the sifted sugar dusted around the edges of the shoe and almost calls him back, knows that there are far worse things for a woman to be than a kind man's wife. It would be so much easier than being a single-minded woman with a chalk drawing on the floor of her boarding-house bedroom mapping out every vein and nerve and artery and organ she reads about, adding notations about the size and properties of each. It would be so much easier if I did not want to know everything so badly, if I did not want so badly to be reliant upon no soul but myself. When Monty, Percy and I returned to England after what can be generously called a tour, the idea of a life in Edinburgh as an independent woman was thrilling. The university had a newly minted medical school. The Royal Infirmary allowed student observation. An anatomy theatre was being built in College Garden. It was the city where Alexander Platt had arrived after his dishonourable navy discharge, with no references and no prospects, and had made a name for himself simply by refusing to stop talking about the radical notions that had gotten him booted from the service. Edinburgh had given Alexander Platt a leg up from nothing, because it had seen in him a brilliant mind. No matter that it came from a working-class lad with no experience and a stripped title. I was certain that it would do the same for me. Instead, I was here, in a bake shop, with a proposal pastry. Callum is kind, I tell myself as I stare at the cream puff. Callum is sweet. Callum loves bread and wakes early and cleans up after himself. He doesn't mind that I don't wear cosmetics and make very little attempt to dress my hair. He listens to me, and he doesn't make me feel unsafe. I could do much worse than a kind man. The scent of sugar and wood smoke starts to return to the room as Callum smothers the ovens, drowning out the faint hint of blood that still lingers, sharp and metallic as a new sewing needle. I do not want to spend the rest of my life smelling sugar. I don't want pastry beneath my fingernails, and a man content with the hand life has dealt him, and my heart a hungry, wild creature savaging me from the inside out. Fleeing to London had truly been a fiction, but suddenly it begins to unspool in my head. London isn't a medical hub like Edinburgh. But there are hospitals and plenty of physicians who offer private classes. There's a guild. None of the hospitals or private offices or even barbaric barber surgeons on the grass market have allowed me to get a toe in their door. But the hospitals in London don't know my name. I'm smarter now, after a year of rejection. I've learned not to walk in with pistols drawn, but rather to keep them hidden in my petticoats, with a hand surreptitiously upon the heel. This time, I will approach stealthily. Find a way to make them let me in before I ever have to show my hand. And what is the point of having a fallen gentleman in the city for a brother if I don't take advantage of his gentlemanly hospitality? London. 2. Moorfields is a stinking, rotting neighbourhood that greets me like a fist to the teeth. The noise is fantastic. Sermons of preachers damning the poor from street corners argue with screams from the brothels. Cattle bellow as they're herded through the road to market. Tinkers call for pots to mend. Vendors sell oysters, nuts, apples, fish, turnips, new wares every few steps, all of them oily and all of them shouted about. I'm ankle-deep in mud all the way from the stagecoach stop, the thick, greasy sort that traps carts and steals shoes. Dead cats and rotten fruit bob up from the quagmire, and the thick haze of smoke and gin makes the air feel gauzy. It's miraculous that I do not have my pockets picked on the walk, and will be equally miraculous if I ever manage to scrape all the mud and offal off the soles of my boots. My brother, always one for histrionics, has made his fall into poverty as dramatic as possible. Even as I mount the stairs of his building, I'm not certain what emotion is most strongly associated with the impending reunion with Monty. We parted on good terms, or, if not good, at least good adjacent, but only after a lifetime of sniping at each other like feral foxes. And fencing for soft underbellies is a hard habit to break. We've both said enough unkind things to each other that would justify a reluctance on his part to greet me with warmth. So it is unexpected that my first reaction upon seeing his face when he opens the door is perhaps closest cousin to fondness. This miserable year apart has made me terribly soft. What he offers back is shock.
Felicity!
Surprise, I say weakly. Then I throw my hands in the air like it's some sort of celebration and try not to regret coming here at all. Sorry, I can go.
No, don't! Dear Lord, Felicity!
He grabs my arm as I turn, pulling me back to him, and then into an embrace, which I don't know what to do with. I consider trying to pry myself free, but it will likely be over faster if I don't resist. So I stand, stiff-armed and chewing the inside of my cheek.
What are you doing here?
He pushes me back to arm's length for a better look.
And you're so tall! When did you get so tall?
I have never aspired to impressive stature, based primarily on Monty's example. We are both of a solid, hard-to-knock-over stock that sacrifices height for shoulder width. But I've had to let the hem of my skirt out since summer, and in my heeled shoes and him in stocking feet, I could put my nose to his forehead. Pettiness must die a very slow death indeed, because in spite of the momentary pinch of fondness, I'm delighted to be officially taller. His hug prevented me from getting a good look at him until he stepped backward to assess my height, and I examine him in return. He's gotten thinner. That's the first thing I notice. Thin in a way that can no longer be described as willowy, but rather the sort that comes from not having enough to eat. He's paler as well, though that's less alarming. The last time we saw each other, we'd just finished a stretch in the Cyclades Islands, so we were both of us brown as nuts. The short, bleak days that populate London in the winter have made it impossible not to notice the scars on his face, far more livid than I expected. They run raised and red, like a splatter of paint across his forehead, and in patches down to his neck, made more visible because he's cut his hair short, though it somehow still has that effortless tousle to it, like someone sculpted it to look rumpled just so.
Here! Come inside!
Monty ushers me into the flat, floorboards protesting more loudly than I feel they should while still maintaining structural stability. I haul myself and my knapsack over the threshold. The flat is crowded as a party. There's a wash basin, balanced atop a set of trunks stacked on each other that seem to be functioning as both storage and a dining table, bumping knees with a sooty stove that looks like it's pushing down the floor. I consider taking off my boots, but decide I'd rather not risk trodding these boards sock-footed for fear of a splinter impaling me. Monty steps into the middle of what can be generously termed the front room, though there's only a thin partition to designate its edges.
I know it's shit,
he says, before I have to come up with a compliment that is actually a lie.
But it's our shit, so long as we pay the rent, which we have, mostly. Only one close call so far, and we have a stove, which is grand, and there are significantly fewer cockroaches than there were in the summer. More mice now, but fewer cockroaches.
He does a little victorious gesture with his hands clasped above his head.
Here, Percy's in bed. Come say your hellos. I think he's still awake.
Why is Percy abed? I follow Monty around the partition as Percy raises his head from where he's burrowed into their mattress. He hasn't become as dramatically waifish as Monty, though his dark skin hides any pallor. That, and Percy has been a stretched-out creature since youth, every suit a bit too short in the sleeves, and his limbs thin with lean muscles jutting out like tangerines wrapped in burlap. It occurs to me suddenly why the pair of them may be lounging in the middle of the day, and I freeze, blushing, before I have confirmation of my suspicions. Oh no, am I interrupting something marital and romantic?
Felicity, please. It's 6 in the evening,
Monty says with great indignance, then adds,
we've been fornicating all day.
I resist using up my first eye roll on the visit this early. Really, Percy, why are you in bed?
Because it has not been a very good week.
Monty sinks down at Percy's side and nestles into his shoulder, his deaf side away from me. Percy gives me a weak smile, his head listing against Monty's.
Just a fit yesterday, he says,
and Monty wrinkles his nose at the word. Oh. It comes out more relieved than I meant it to. I'm far more comfortable discussing epilepsy than fornication. Percy is an epileptic, temporarily incapacitated at periodic intervals by convulsions that physicians since Hippocrates have been attempting, and largely failing, to both understand and treat. After several years of his guardian aunt and uncle bringing a parade of so-called experts in to cup and bleed and dose him in attempt to lessen the severity, they finally decided upon permanent imprisonment in the sort of barbaric asylum that people with untreatable ills are confined to. It would have happened, too, had he not absconded with my brother. So dedicated were they to keeping his illness a secret for fear of the social embarrassment that neither Monty nor I knew of it until we were abroad. I am tempted to ask after the paper I sent the previous month on homeopathy and the treatment of convulsive fits through quinine. But Percy looks drowsy and ill, and Monty will stop listening once I begin to talk of anything medical. So all I say instead is, epilepsy is a son of a bitch.
Oh my, but Scotland has made you vulgar, Monty says with delight. What brings you down from those highlands to us? Not that this isn't a delightful surprise, but it is a surprise. Did you write? Because you reached us before the letter.
No, this was unplanned. I look down at my shoes as a chunk of some unknown substance crumbles from the sole. I have never been good at asking things of others, and it sticks in my throat. I was hoping you'd put me up for a bit.
Are you all right?
Percy asks, which should have been my brother's first question, though I'm not shocked it wasn't.
Oh, I'm fine. I try to make it sound sincere, for I am well in all the ways he's concerned for.
I'm feeling rather trapped between the foot of the bed and the partition. When I try to scoot back, I nearly knock the screen over entirely. I can find somewhere else to stay, a boarding house or something.
But Monty waves that away.
Don't be absurd. We can make room.
Where? I almost say. But they're both watching me with such a thick undercoat of concern, it makes me look down again at my shoes. Eye contact in return somehow feels both too vulnerable and too invasive, so I mumble, sorry.
What are you sorry for?
Monty asks. I was sorry that my great plan hadn't worked out. Sorry I was here relying on my brother's Christian charity, what little he had to spare, because my plan for my future had lost its footing at every mile marker. Because I was born a girl, but too stubborn to accept the lot that came with my sex.
Felicity?
Monty sits up and leans forward with his arms around his knees, looking very intently at me.
Apologise for nothing. It has been made clear in many a letter you are always welcome with us. I was anticipating if you ever took us up on that offer, there would be some notice, so you'll have to put up with our current states of invalidity and concern for said invalidity. But had you written, I swear to God our answer would have been board the first coach south.
Thank God. Something I can be indignant about. It's far more comfortable than sentimentality.
Many a letter? Really?
When Monty gives me a quizzical look, I fill in,
You have not once written to me.
I write?
No. Percy writes me long, lovely letters in his very legible penmanship, and then you scrawl something offensive at the bottom about Scottish men and their kilts. Monty grins, unsurprisingly, but Percy snorts as well. When I glare at him, he pulls the quilt up over his nose.
Don't encourage him.
Monty leans over and gives a gentle nip at Percy's jaw, then presses a kiss to the same spot.
Oh, he loves it when I'm filthy.
I look away, right at a pair of trousers tellingly discarded upon the floor, and resign myself to the fact that their affection is unavoidable, particularly if I'm to be staying with them.
Are you two still nauseatingly obsessed with each other? I thought by now you'd have mellowed.
We remain completely unbearable. Come here, my most dearest, darling love of loves.
Monty pulls Percy's face toward him and kisses him on the mouth this time, sloppy and showy, and somehow he manages to look at me the whole time as if to convey just how smug he is about making me uncomfortable. That initial fondness I felt toward him has already begun to rot like an overripe melon. I can resist the eye roll no longer, though I fear for my vision as soon as I look to the ceiling. It seems to be peeling off in chalky lumps. If there is a piece of this flat that isn't playing skip rope with the line between habitable and condemned, I have yet to see it. I will leave. When they pull apart, Percy at least has the good sense to look sheepish about the show. Monty just looks obnoxiously pleased with himself. Somehow his dimples are even jauntier than I remember them.
He's showing off, Percy assures me. We never touch each other.
Well, please don't start for my benefit, I reply.
Come here, darling, and we'll give you a cuddle as well. Monty pats the bed between them. A proper Monty-Percy sandwich.
I give him a sweet smile in return. Oh, darling, I'd rather set myself on fire. It has taken me, admittedly, a time to reconcile the idea that Percy and Monty seem to have found honest affection for each other in what I was taught was the sin of all sins. Perhaps the distance helped, or at least gave me space to ponder it and make my peace with it, a move from cringing tolerance to something nearer to understanding that their love is probably truer than most of the pairings I saw growing up. Anyone who put up with my brother
certainly would not be doing it unless they really, sincerely loved him. And Percy's the sort of decent lad who actually might. When stripped of the illegalities and the biblical condemnation, their attraction is no stranger to me than anyone's attraction to anyone. Percy nudges the side of Monty's head with his nose.
You should get to work.
Must I? He replies. Felicity just arrived.
I perk up in a way that I'm certain makes me look more squirrel-like than is flattering, but I can't resist a taunt. It's owed him after that clogged drain of a kiss.
I'm sorry, Percy. I'm not sure I heard right, because it sounded as though you said work, which would imply that my brother has tricked someone into employing him.
Thank you. I have been consistently employed since we arrived in London, Monty says. Percy coughs, and he adds, somewhat consistently.
I follow Monty around the partition, perching myself at its edge so I can keep them both in my conversation as Monty starts pawing his way through the trunks. May I guess what sort of employment you're rushing off to?
You're a horse jockey.
No, wait, a nightclub performer, a bare-knuckled boxer, a brothel bully.
From the bed, Percy laughs.
He'd be smaller than most of the tarts.
Ha ha ha! I won't have you two ganging up on me while you're here.
Monty surfaces from a trunk with a jumper that looks like it was vomited up by an aging house cat and wrestles it over his head.
I'll have you know,
he says as he fights to get his hands through the sleeves,
that I have a respectable position in Covent Garden.
Respectable?
I cross my arms. That sounds fake.
It's not. It's very respectable, isn't it, Percy? He calls.
But Percy has suddenly become occupied with a thread coming undone from the quilt.
So tell me what it is you're doing respectably in Covent Garden, I say, with an eyebrow arched over the neighbourhood.
As a newly monogamous man, he pretends to not understand my emphasis on the notorious cruising grounds he once frequented.
I play cards for a casino.
You play for the casino?
I stay sober, but pretend to be drunk to play against the men who actually are tipsy and win their money and give it to the house. They pay me a portion.
I let out a bark of laughter before I can stop myself. Yes, respectable is the first word that comes to my mind when I hear that.
Better than making plum cakes with your little plum cake, he returns with a sly grin.
And suddenly, none of it is fun or funny any longer. It's the savage sniping of our youth, both of us jabbing gently until someone presses a little too hard and it draws blood. Monty might not sense the change in the weather, but Percy does, for he says sternly to Monty,
"Be nice. She's only been here 20 minutes.
"Has it only been 20 minutes? I mumble, and Percy swats his hand at me.
You have to be nice too. That road runs both ways.
Yes, mother, I say, and Monty laughs, this time less at me than with me, and we trade a look that is, shall we say, not hostile,
which is good enough.
It takes Monty an excessively long time to dress. There's the jumper, mostly obscured by a jacket and an overly large coat, then heavy boots and fraying gloves, all topped by an adorably misshapen cap that I like to imagine Percy knit for him. It also takes him half a dozen false starts before he actually manages to reach the street. First, he has to come back for his scarf, then to change into thicker socks. But most times, the thing he comes back for is one more kiss with Percy. When Monty finally leaves in earnest, the whole building seems to tip a bit more westward when the door slams behind him. Percy smiles at me and pats the spot on the bed beside him.
You can sit down, if you like. I promise I won't try to cuddle you.
I perch myself on the edge of the bed. I'm assuming he's going to dive face first into an interrogation on the subject of why exactly I have made my bedraggled appearance on their doorstep begging for shelter. But instead he says,
"Thank you for the paper you sent."
I was so prepared to make protestations that my surprise visit to London is not a sign of an impending crisis that I turn a bit too hard into this subject.
Wasn't it fascinating? I mean, it's annoying that he calls it St. Valentine's Malady, the whole bleeding paper, but it's brilliant how many physicians are advocating alternatives to bloodlettings and surgeries, particularly for a disease like epilepsy, where we still don't have much of a real idea where it originates. And his footnote about the unlikeliness of epilepsy having any relation to illicit sexual desires was gratifying. That isn't often acknowledged. But the whole idea of a consistent preventative dose of pharmaceuticals rather than treating in a moment of crisis, preventative rather than prescriptive, for a chronic illness that doesn't manifest every... I trail off. I can tell Percy is struggling to follow so many words spouted so quickly and with so much vigour. Sorry, I'm rambling.
Don't be sorry. I wish I had something intelligent to offer in return. Maybe when I'm a bit more...
He waves a hand vaguely to indicate his current invalidity. Have you tried anything suggested? He makes a good case for quinine.
Not yet. We don't have the money right now. But the Royal Academy of Music here in London will be looking for violinists in the fall, and one of the lads in my quartet is a student of Bononcini and said he'd introduce me. I'm hoping something will come of that.
He leans back against the headboard as he studies me, legs curling into his chest so that his toes are no longer hanging off the end of the bed.
Are you all right?
Me? Yes, of course.
Because we're very happy to see you, but your arrival seems rather unplanned, which would cause a concerned party to wonder if you had left Edinburgh in some kind of distress.
It would give cause, wouldn't it? I hope my casual tone might stall him, but he goes on staring at me, and I sigh, my posture sinking into a very unladylike slouch. Mr. Doyle, the baker, you know, the one I work for. Percy nods, and I continue with great reluctance. He has expressed an interest in some day making a proposal of marriage to me. I expected some fantastic start, the same sort of surprise that struck me when Callum made the actual ask, but Percy's face hardly changes.
How very clinical.
You don't seem surprised.
Should I be? Were you?
Yes! How did you know?
Because of everything you wrote about him. Unmarried gentlemen don't pay young ladies that sort of attention unless they have long-term plans. Though, I suppose you Montagues are first rate at not noticing when someone is smitten with you.
He might mean for it to make me laugh, but instead, I take a strong interest in picking at the pills of wool on my skirt where my rucksack rubbed.
You don't sound very excited.
Well, considering that after he asked me, I immediately booked a carriage here and wrote to St. Bartholomew's about an appointment with the Hospital Governor's Board, I can't say that I am.
I thought you liked Callum.
These woolly little bastards are really clinging. I catch the ragged edge of my thumbnail in the grain of the material and pull up a loop of thread. I do. He's kind and he makes me laugh, sometimes, if the joke is clever, and he works very hard. But I like a lot of people. I like you. Doesn't mean I want to marry you.
Thank God, because I'm spoken for.
I'm resisting the urge to fall face forward into the bed. I would have been more likely to indulge had I not been concerned that the mattress would offer no give and I'd be left with a broken nose. Callum is sweet, and he's helped me. But he thinks he's saving me from all my ambition, when really I can't see any future scenario where I come to be as interested in Callum as I am in medicine, or interested in anyone that much, or interested in doing anything other than studying medicine. I release a long breath, fluttering the fine hairs escaping my plaid. But I could do much worse than a kind baker who owns a shop and worships me.
In my experience, it's less gratifying for both parties if that worship is single-sided.
Percy rubs a hand over his face. I can tell he's getting drowsy, and I think he might beg to retire, but instead he says,
"Not to abandon this subject entirely, but can we return to something for a moment? What was that about the St. Bart's Hospital Board?"